Okay, my clock says 9 o'clock. Rabbi Kelman isn't here, but we have a lot to do today, so I want to start. We will be, I don't think we're going to be finishing with Rav Nissim today, although we'll get close to finishing. Then we'll have one more class dealing with partly with Rav Nissim, and also we'll move on to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Before we begin, I do want to respond. A number of you sent me emails, so there's a number of things I'll respond to. First, before even getting to that, those who are interested more in what we've been dealing with, the various chief rabbis, let me show you a volume you might find interesting. Harabanut HaRashit Yisrael, 70 years since its founding, three big, thick volumes, which go through all aspects of the chief rabbinate, the various chief rabbis, the halachic decisions, et cetera, dealing with Shabbos, the army, all sorts of interesting stuff. A few other things I want to respond, because people wanted me to clarify. Briefly, we mentioned last time a bit about the Zecher-Zachar business, so someone asked me to clarify it, so let me just take 2 minutes to do that. Those who want more information, you can I can send you a copy of this little book, HaRav Mordechai Breuer, Mikraot Sheyesh Lehem Hechayah. And it's a kuntras dealing with three things. So what are the three things? Well, first, a bit about who this Mordechai Breuer is. There are two Mordechai Breuers. We've mentioned them a number of times. There's the professor Mordechai Breuer, who passed away a couple of years ago, the scholar of German Orthodoxy. And then there's also Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, the outstanding biblical scholar, the winner of the Pras Yisrael, the creator, really, of a new approach, a new way of looking at understanding of Tanakh. He basically accepts the Wellhausen approach, but argues that this is just insights into how the Divine Torah was written. Some of you might have seen this book, Shitat HaPrinot, or Mordechai Breuer, which has all of his essays plus responses. It does not have this little essay. The problem is you're going to hear on Shabbos, when they read Parsha Zachar, they're going to say Timche es Zecher Amalek, and then they're going to read the whole pasuk over and say Timche es Zecher Amalek. Now, I've always been very attentive to this because that's my bar mitzvah parsha, Kiseitse. So I can certainly affirm that when I was younger, I don't know, until about 10 years ago, what they said was they read Timche es Zecher Amalek, Timche es Zecher Amalek. They just repeated those few words. I think today, every single show I go to, they repeat the entire pasuk, in which, as we'll see, there's no evidence anywhere that I know of that you should do this. But it's got to the point where if I was the Baal Korei and I did the way they were doing 15 years ago, I guarantee the Gabbai would say to me, you have to repeat the whole pasuk. So where does this all come from? There seems to be evidence, or there's two reports on how the Vilna Gaon read it. Rav Chaim of Volozhin said he heard from the Vilna Gaon and he read it Zecher. And there's another book, the Maaseh Rav, which reports the Vilna Gaon's practices, that says he read it Zecher. We know that there were some followers of Vilna Gaon that read it, that presumably read it both ways. This really didn't become popular, however, until the Mishnah Berurah said that, as we know, the Mishnah Berurah likes to be Yotzei Kol Adeos, likes to fulfill all different practices. So he suggested do both. And Hasidim also somehow picked up on this, and that's where the practice among the Ashkenazim is to do both. It wasn't even a universal practice 40 years ago, 50 years ago, as you could see, as I mentioned last class from Meshulam Roth's tshuva on the topic. What Mordechai Breuer wants to show is that there's no reason to repeat it at all. That we have a Masorah, the Masorah has told us what to do, this is just something nice that maybe some people want to do, but it's never been the practice until recently, and he wants to go back and, as they say, l'hachzir atara l'yoshna, but no such luck. When these practices get started, you can't go back. Yitzhak Penkauer, Jordan Penkauer, also has a very lengthy essay discussing the practice, how it was always standard throughout all of Jewish history to just say Zecher, and now things have changed. He also deals with two other aspects. If you pay attention to the Megillat Esther, you'll hear them repeat two other words, l'harog, Uharog and Bifneihem and Lifneihem. Again, there's no doubt about any of these, how they should be read, but in recent years, doubts, so-called doubts, have been created, so now they read it again. Yaakov Spiegel, incidentally, wrote more on this, and he points out that in recent years, certain Hasidic groups have added more words that you repeat. So that's that. And one more thing I was asked to comment on, and that's the psak given today by Rav Avadi Yosef. Apparently it's making all sorts of headlines that a woman can read the Megillah for men. Haaretz picked up on this. Let me tell you how this works. The newspapers, the secular newspapers, would always send people to hear Rav Avadi Yosef's shiurim Saturday night. Why? Because every now and then he'd say something shocking, and this then would become news. Now they don't have to. They're all online. You can listen to them. Maran1.com. You can hear it for yourself. All the classics, the controversial ones, the reasons for the tsunami, and everything else recorded there. So someone listened to it, a reporter, who's not that much of a Talmud Chacham, and picked up that he said in the shiur last Saturday night, I listened to it earlier today, that a woman can read Megillah for a man. Now, this is nothing new. What he says in it is that if it's an emergency, if there's no men who are capable of reading it, or you're in a place where there's no men who are good at it, a woman can read. No big deal. What I think is interesting, however, is that a lot of people have discussed this on their blogs today. I did a search and I found this. And you have a lot of chachamim going around saying that this only applies to Sephardim. It doesn't apply to Ashkenazim. Why do they say this? I think they're absolutely incorrect, as I'll explain to you. They say this because if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, after the Shulchan Aruch says that woman can be motzi, can fulfill the obligation for men. This is in 689. He said, and then he said, there are those who say that a woman can't be motzi a man, and the idea is always that if the second, when he says there are those who say, that's not the important thing. The important thing is the previous one. And then Ramosha Isserle says, there are those who say that a woman can read for herself, but she makes a different bracha. So the simple understanding, certainly of the Ramah, of Ramosha Zisserlis, is that the woman is not motzi the man. However, all these people going around saying that Rav Avadi Yosef says that his psak is only for Sephardim, not for Ashkenazim, not only is there absolutely no evidence that he holds this, the evidence is just the opposite. First of all, when Rav Avadi Yosef paskins, he tells you if it's a difference between man and woman. I mean, not man and woman, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Here he states an explicit halakha. And all these people are quoting various sources. No one quotes this work. Chazon Avadia on Purim, where he has a whole discussion. He says the exact same thing. He was quoting by heart what he writes. He goes into detail, explains it, quotes the different opinions. No distinction whatsoever among Ashkenazim and Sephardim. He says you should have a man read it, but if you don't have a man, then you can have a woman. And we all know that for Rav Avadia Yosef in the land of Israel, with rare exceptions, one of the exceptions is Kitnios, which is so important, but other than that, he assumes that Ashkenazim should follow the position of the Shulchan Aruch as well. So there is no question that Rav Avadia's psak applies in the land of Israel to everyone. So what about in the diaspora? Even then, all these chachamim who seem to know Rav Avadia's mind, you would have to look very carefully at Rav Avadia, how he understands the klolim, the ways that the Ramah works. Because the Ramah doesn't say that it's forbidden. What the Ramah says is that there are those who say that a woman can't do this. I assume, since the Rav Avadia doesn't even mention the Ramah, that his assumption is, as he concludes, that the Ramah is speaking in general. You shouldn't do this. That's the general approach. But in an emergency, we can rely on the other authorities. And he quotes numerous Ashkenazic authorities, including Rashi and the Meiri and others, who say that a woman can be motzi a man. So I just have to sit back and marvel that all these people speak about what they know, and this includes Gil Student, Jeffrey Wolf, people who are learned, that they know exactly what Rav Avadia Yosef thinks, and none of them, as I said, has bothered looking, in which he goes on for pages with all his notes, and you don't see this at all. So I assume that this is his psak, that the Ramah is only speaking in a general case, but if it's an emergency, if it's a choice between reading the Megillah and not reading the Megillah, He holds that you have a woman read the Megillah, and we have precedent for this with women getting Aliyah. He shows that we don't have to take into account the view that it's not covered on Tzibor, or that there's an issue of a Kol Isha, of a woman chanting it. So all I can say is there's not even a hint of evidence that he distinguishes Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And if you look at his notes, he's quoting all the Ashkenazic authorities who hold this position as well. Yeah, it could be a sociological difference. My only point is that all these people are going around saying that his sock is only for Sephardim, and it's not that at all. Okay, and finally, I just want to thank Dov Weinstein, who's a bit of an expert on Rav Avadia's Tshuvot, for last week calling my attention. Anyone who's interested in the business of making the Baruch of Shechianu after seeing someone 30 days, you can look in Yechaveh Da'at, Volume 4, number 17, and you'll find all the details. With that, unless there's any other comments or questions, we can move on. I just want to say one more thing before we start. You know, I know the times are hard economically. I don't know if Rabbi Kelman has mailed out anything, but if anyone can make a donation of sorts, it certainly will be appreciated, but better than that, take a look. Look around on the Torah in Motion website. You'll see plenty of very interesting talks, shiurim. If you want to download a few, I'm sure Torah in Motion would appreciate it very much, and you can put it on your MP3. You'll enjoy it as well. Okay. Let us then pick up where we left off. We left off last class. I mentioned that shortly before his death, Rav Uziel came to Rav Nissim and asked him to run, that he should become the next chief rabbi, and how this was going to be something different, because Rav Nissim had never served as Rav anywhere, but he agreed to do that after others such as Rav Maimon, Rav Tzipetzach Frank, and Rav Herzog got involved as well. Now, they actually had to create a system for the election of a chief rabbi, because a chief rabbi had never before been appointed, been elected, that is, in the state of Israel. So they created electoral bodies. Half the people or a third of the people were rabbis of cities. The others were members of the various political parties. You had all sorts of non-religious people also. But sometimes you hear people, you know, Nitzrei Karta types, maybe Satmar types, talking how it's an invalid election because you have non-religious people involved in the voting. The fact of the matter is that every European city in Poland, every East European city, Poland, Lithuania, and the like, the chief rabbi of that city, the Rav of the city, anyone from the Brisker Rav to Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, Rav Yitzchak Chanan, I don't know how many non-religious had in those days, but certainly in the 20th century, some of these cities were controlled by the non-religious. So the non-religious have always been involved in appointments of the members of the rabbinate. You had Bundes, and you had all sorts of people on the committee, and there were all sorts of battles. You had Zionists and the like. So this is hardly something new. After all, many of the non-religious also need a rabbi sometimes. So I guess they have a say also. The election was held in 1955, and Rav Nissim's only real opponent was Rav Yaakov Moshe Toledano, a figure that we will deal with later in the course. A very interesting Sephardic authority. And Rav Nissim wins. He receives 42 votes. Rav Toledano gets 27. In 1959, Rav Herzog passes away, and until 1964, Rav Nissim is the only chief rabbi of the state of Israel. As we know, we mentioned already a few times this strange system of a Sephardic and Ashkenazic chief rabbi. Certainly in 1948, one would have thought that 60 years later, there wouldn't be any need. If you need a chief rabbi at all, there wouldn't be any need for an Ashkenazic and a Sephardic chief rabbi. Well, what's the whole point? An Ashkenazic Rav can paskin for a Sephardi, and a Sephardi can paskin for an Ashkenazi. They know the difference in Hagim. Are we so ethnocentric that we need to have we only need to have one who's in our group? As chief rabbi, Rav Nissim immediately begins to reach out to all segments of the population in a way that really recalls what Rav Kook did. Rav Kook's famous mission to the various secular kibbutzim in the north, Rav Nissim does the same thing. He goes to visit all the kibbutzim, tries to bring Torah to them. In fact, his involvement with the non-religious was so significant that the Vatican newspaper, Osservatore Romano, referred to it, discussed it, and mentioned that what the chief rabbi of Israel is doing should be a model for all us religious people in how we reach out to the non-religious. Actually, the newspaper spoke about how we can learn from him how to bring the communists back to religion. Italy has always had a strong communist party. And as I said, in this, Rav Nissim is following the path of Rav Kook. He also traveled around the entire world. By then, planes were easily available. He went to Europe and to America. He went to Montreux, Switzerland, where Rav Weinberg was with him and described him in a letter as a great man, a gon in hora'ah, in Pesach, in accordance with the Sephardic approach, and a gentleman with wonderful midot. So I found that interesting. In Italy, he went to Livorno, Leghorn, and while there, arranges for the bones, the coffin of the Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, to be brought to the land of Israel. And he was brought to Israel, and there was a great funeral, and they reinterred him. If you go now to Har HaMenuchos, you will see the important grave there. The Chidah really is, I said in my class on Rav Avadia, and I repeat, from the days of the Shulchan Aruch to Rav Avadia, the most significant figure was the Chidah. I believe that from the Shulchan Aruch until Rav Avadia Yosef, only three figures have been known as Maran, consistently. The Maran, Rav Yosef Karo, the Chidah, and they said from Yosef to Yosef, there rose none like Yosef. And that originally referred to Yosef Karo to Chaim Joseph David Azulai. And then we have Maran Ovadia Yosef, and now when you say from Joseph to Joseph, it refers to Yosef Karo to Ovadia Yosef. It's really the most significant Sephardic figure in the 18th century, and his grave was transferred. He then goes to America in 1967, and it's a very memorable visit. Some of you listening might be graduates of Yeshiva University and might remember his visit there to YU. He comes to YU actually a year later in 1968. The Rav said, Rav Soloveitchik said something interesting in his talk before the students. He said that he always wondered what the Rambam looked like. You know, the Rambam had been his best friend from his youth. The Rav speaks about when he was young, his best friend was the Rambam. As geniuses like him often are the case, he didn't really have any real friends, but the Rambam was his friend. And he really had never met Rav Soloveitchik, until he met Rav Nissim, had never really met a Sephardic Rav. I'm sure he met rabbis of Mark Angel and the like in New York, but I mean a real Sephardic Rav of the old school, certainly with the dress. He said he always imagined what the Rambam looked like, and after meeting Rav Nissim, he knows. Rav Nissim, for his part, in front of everyone, calls upon the Rav to make Aliyah, to leave the diaspora and come to the land of Israel and bring his students. In fact, he did more. He turned to the students and said, "Can any of you explain why you are not coming in Aliyah?" And then he turns to the Rosh Yeshiva and Rav Belkin, Dr. Belkin, and says to them, "Why are you not coming in Aliyah?" Rav Nissim was a real advocate, an apostle for return to the land of Israel. He even suggests that none of these students should receive smicha until they study in the land of Israel. It wasn't long after this that Yeshiva University opens up the Grus Kollel, where there was a theory that the students would go. I think at one time they thought that every student, unless there are certain emergencies, but every student would study in Israel before receiving smicha. I believe the JTS also has that the students, if you have family problems, I guess you can get a waiver, but all students have to study in Israel. And Rav Nissim said that now Israel is on the center. No one should be able to get smicha until they study in Israel. It gets even more interesting. He then goes to Montreal, where he spends time with Rav Hirschsprung. Pinchas Hirschsprung, the greatest Torah scholar in Canada, certainly the greatest in Montreal, who also was very close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He suggests to Rav Nissim that when he returns to New York, he go meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe. After all, how can you come to America and not meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Rav Nissim and Rav Hirschsprung could make the call and make all the arrangements. Rav Hirschsprung says, "Fine, I'll go meet the Rebbe on condition that he visits Israel, even for one day, goes to the western wall, the Kotel, prays there, and gives praise to God in the place that Shlina has not left. Rav Nissim says, as long as the Rebbe refuses to do this, I'm not going to go visit the Rebbe. And the word came back that the Rebbe is not going to the land of Israel. And Rebbe had his reasons, I guess. And Rav Nissim refuses to meet the Rebbe. He snubs the Rebbe. Unimaginable in later years. In later years, Menachem Begin, every time he comes to Israel, he goes meets the Rebbe. Shazar, who himself comes from Chabad, would go meet the Rebbe. But Begin was from Amistad Bisham, he's from Brisk, and he would go meet the Rebbe. And people in Israel didn't like this. You know, the newspapers, the Haaretz and the Lake, were saying that the Prime Minister of Israel is going to meet with some rabbi out in Brooklyn. Now, where's the, you know, that's not the way the Prime Minister of Israel shouldn't be going to meet with these small-time rabbis. Of course, from Begin's standpoint, from Shazar's standpoint, he himself was from Chabad, so this was his Rebbe, as it were. And Begin met with Moshe Feinstein, the Rav. He was a real respecter of Torah scholars, something obviously that the Haaretz couldn't understand. But Rav Nissim was firm that it is not his place to go visit a rabbi in Brooklyn who doesn't think that the land of Israel is important enough. Yes, thank you, Mark, for pointing that out. I think even HUC requires or strongly recommends. Rav Nissim was also friendly with another one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, Rav David Lipschitz. In fact, I showed you this book last time that my father was nice enough to give me because he picked it up at the Yeshiva University dinner a few months ago, which was in honor of Rav Zvulun Harlap. Rav Harlap, the grandson of Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap, the great friend, student of Rav Kook. His son comes to America, becomes rabbi in the Bronx, and it was a huge community, and Rav Harlap takes over. It also was a very large community. I remember last year in the Jewish Week, they wrote about how they have trouble getting in Minyan now. It's not too far from Montefiore Hospital, but they gave him this sefer, Zeved Tov, I guess Zeved from Zvulun. They use the Zvulun Harlap. Zeved is also, it means like a gift or a bounty. There's a practice, it begins in the Sephardic world, but now is also found in the Ashkenazic world, called a Zeved Bat, which when a girl is born, there's some prayers you read. It's a nice little service. Instead of a Shalom Zachar, now they call it a Shalom Bat, but this is called a Zeved Bat. I actually was at one in West Orange, my town, a couple years ago. In this book, which really has articles by a number of the Rosh Yeshiva and the like, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky has a piece. He includes the letters back and forth between Rav Nissim and Rav David Lifshitz. They were very friendly. Most of these letters deal with Rav David Lifshitz's great love of the land of Israel, his desire to go on Aliyah, which never really worked out because they needed to arrange him to get a position and the like. There's other aspects that it deals with, so you see the close friendship they have. Another thing of interest I'll just mention, since I have the sefer here, there's a number of things here, not just from dealing with the Rosh Yeshiva YU, there's things from the different Harlaps, from his children, Zvonokhov's children, from his grandfather, his father was a big Talmud Chacham, and there's a section of letters from Gdol Yisrael to Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap. And, yes, Rabbi Hirsch, not only did Rav David Lifshitz go for a few years, when I was at BMT, he came and gave a shiur. Now, it was the first time I ever heard a shiur in Ashkenazic Hebrew. I mean, that's the way he gave his shiur. So, on page 103 of this volume, you have something very interesting. There is a letter from Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap to Rav Chizkiya Yosef Mishkovsky, who was a big rav in Lithuania, then later comes to Israel. I think he was in Kfar Hasidim, replying to the request that Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, this is 1926, that the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva take in Rav Shimon Shkop as one of the heads of the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. Shortly after this, Rav Shimon Shkop goes to America, where he remains at Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Kolin for a year. Why he left, there's a lot of speculation. I think the standard view is that his yeshiva in Europe, in Grodno, was falling apart, and therefore he had to go back. But he was there for a year, and one of the famous pictures in front of the new building that they set up, Hadrach Shimon Shkup. In fact, if you go to the YU Svarim sale, they have a table with all the YU Rosh Yeshiva, and they put Rav Shimon Shkup there because for 1 year he served as a Rosh Yeshiva. Why do they need someone else at Merkaz Harav? Because a great rabbi, who I'm sure that no one here has heard of, maybe one of you has, or two of you, Rav Avram Aaron Bernstein of Tavrig, had recently passed away. Now, who was he? He's entirely forgotten today, although you can buy one of his Sfarim from Merkaz Harav if you go online. But in Making of a Gadol, Kamenetsky refers to him as one of the three greatest Rosh Yeshiva of his time. First being Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the second being Rav Itzel Aponovej, or Itzel Rabinovitz Aponovej, and the third being Bernstein of Tavri. He was in Slobodka. In fact, when Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was asked in 1925 about the Auschwitz problem, about the issue of separating from the non-Orthodox communities in Germany, he said that one of the people you should ask is Bernstein, or Avram Bernstein. He also says in this letter something quite interesting, that in going through the different gedolim, who will answer, who won't. He says Rameir Simcha of Divinsk won't answer. He doesn't want to get involved in politics. But Rameir Simcha, the Or Sameach, who will do a class in the future on, he calls him the Gadol Hador. So that, I think, is quite interesting. Incidentally, Bernstein's son was the Labor Party figure, Reuven Barkat, who was the Speaker of the Knesset from 1969 to 1972. Just another of the Gedolim whose children became involved in Israeli politics. I don't know if any of them actually became involved in the revisionist side. Many of them became involved in the labor side. We'll see also when we do for C. Pesach Frank, we have an example like this as well. But Barkat was a leading figure. In fact, I mentioned Rav Shimon Shkup, his granddaughter, as we mentioned in the previous class, was very active in Israeli politics. She was actually the head of the Communist Party in Israel. So it's quite interesting. Rav Harlap writes back. Yes, we'll get to Moshe Nissen, but Moshe Nissen remained Orthodox his entire life, as far as I know. I never met him. I'm assuming he was. But you're right, Rav Moshe Nissen did go to the Likud. Rav Moshe Nissen, however, is from a later era. I'm talking about this earlier era. I'm sure there are some. I just don't know. Rav Harlap writes that the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva is not going to take Rav Shimon Shkup. Why? Because they intend on following the path of the Vilna Gaon. And he says that even though the analytic approach, that is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's approach, Rav Shimon's approach, is valuable, the main direction of the yeshiva is pshat, the simple explanation, and directed towards practical halakha. He says, I'll read the Hebrew for those, that Ikar mahalech limud ha-yeshiva tiyeh al-pi sidro v'darko shel hagra. And then he says, even though we know that darche hazmarot ha-havanot is valuable, about ikar ruach ha-yeshiva, that the main point of this yeshiva should not be a brisker type of yeshiva. I found that very interesting. Getting back to Rav David Lifshitz, he was also one of the heads of the Agudas HaRabbanim. In the biography of Rav Nissim, this biography, the authors quote a letter from the Agudas HaRabbanim to Rav Nissim when Rav Nissim comes to America, which is quite interesting. When all these gedolim would come to America, the chief rabbis would come to America, they always would speak before the Agudas HaRabbanim. This Agudas HaRabbanim doesn't exist anymore. Agudas HaRabbanim used to be a very powerful organization, founded around 1902, I think, Gedolim for Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. These were the European rabbanim who came to America, the great Talmidei Chachamim. In fact, they refused to allow graduates of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan in because they said, you know, what are these guys? They learn a few years and they're going to be in our group. You know, all the European Rabbanim had learned 10, 15 years in Europe in the great yeshivas before they came to America. It turned out to be a bad mistake because then these rabbis have to form their own group called the Rabbinical Council of America. And over time, the Yiddish-speaking rabbis lose their popularity because the young generation can't relate to them. So by the time you get to the 70s, the Agudas Rabbanim has been totally sidelined, and the RCA is the big organization. And the Agudas Rabbanim's last years were in the 1990s. The last two presidents were Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rav Tibor Stern of Miami. But in those days, no one was paying attention to these European rabbis who, like I said, Many of them never even learned English. But it used to be a powerful organization, and during World War II did a lot of Hatzala work. In fact, a great story is when Rav Avram Shapiro comes, when the Agudas Rabbanim was still functioning, he comes in the 1980s, and when he comes to speak before Agudas Rabbanim, they ask him to speak in Yiddish. And he says, first of all, he can't speak in Yiddish because he's coming as a representative of the land of Israel, so he has to speak in Hebrew. And then he says that if he'd speak in Yiddish, people might think that they're members of Agudas Rabbanim who don't know, if he's speaking in Yiddish, people might think that they're members of Agudas Rabbanim who don't know Hebrew. And he left it at that, which of course was the truth. No, Rav Tibor Stern had nothing to do with Triangle K. Rav Tibor Stern was the Rav HaMachshir for Hebrew National for many, many years, until he passed away about 3 years ago. And then Rabbi Ralbag took over Hebrew National. Of course, they wanted the OU, but the OU now, when you hear what Agudas Rabbanim says about the OU, this will all be very ironic. Because the OU now will not go near non-glot, or not even the fake glot, which they put out. So Rabbi Ralbag took it over. His father is one of the great members of Agudas Rabbanim, still alive. In fact, his father was the one who burnt Mordechai Kaplan's sitter at the famous Agudas Rabbanim meeting in which they burnt it. There's been a lot of discussion about this. Mordechai Kaplan, in his diary, mentions that it was Rabbi Ralbag. I contacted Rabbi Ralbag to find out, did he do this with Agudas Rabbanim support or on his own? He said he did it on his own. I've never published this yet, but it's historically significant because there's all sorts of debates. This became very important. It was in the New York Times, and it made Jews look terrible because this was right, you know, after we saw what the Nazis did to the Jewish books. Another time, maybe I'll tell you, if we deal more with Mordechai Kaplan, I'll tell you the whole story of... But just to show you how the generations have changed, when I called up Rav Aryeh Ralbag, the son, to make the connection with his father, Rav Aryeh Ralbag's son answered the phone. He's learning in Lakewood or something, and before I got to speak to his father, who was finishing up with a get, he asked me why I want to speak to his father, and I told him I want to ask him about, you know, his grandfather's relation with Mordechai Kaplan, and the grandson says to me, who's Mordechai Kaplan? So it's quite interesting. So now, the Tibor Stern, incidentally, you can get a number of his books on HebrewBooks.org. He wrote a proposed constitution for the state of Israel. That's not on HebrewBooks.org, but it's fascinating because there is no constitution. Both him and Rav Herzog, and they dealt with all the issues. How do you have a parliament, et cetera, et cetera. He, in the first few volumes of his Tshuvot, Shavit, it's called, his first name is Shmuel, Shmuel Tibor Stern, Shmuel W. Stern, there's letters from many Gedolim, and he wrote many stories. He wrote a Sefer on Kabbalah. In the Sefer on Kabbalah, which is on HebrewBooks.org, in the end of it, you have his respondent from the 60s about an Erev in Miami Beach, which is where he lived, how you don't need an Erev, that the bridges and the island, it's fine the way it is. He was without question the greatest Talmud Chacham in Miami. Why he was sidelined, etc., again, who knows. I don't know if he was the rabbi at Tower 41. I'm not sure. He had a shtiebel and everything, and I spoke to him a couple of times. I once called him up. I said that, is your hashkacha at Hebrew National only for the conservative Jews, or is it also for B'nai Torah? And he insisted, oh, it's for B'nai Torah also. And then he sent me a letter that Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg sent him, and I included it in the Hebrew volume I published. Now, in this book, on Rav Nissim, the Agudas Rabbanim, they reprint here a letter that the Agudas Rabbanim wrote to Rav Nissim when he comes to America, telling him, this is signed by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Simcha Elberg, and Rav Zalman Reichman. Did he eat the hot dogs? Yes, he certainly ate the hot dogs. In fact, Rabbi Ralbag told me, not only did they eat the hot dogs, he told me they ate the hot dogs in Young Israel of Staten Island, because his son's a rabbi there, too. But yes, so Tibor Stern, if you want to go to his kiddush, I'm sure he'd give you some nice hot dogs. They wrote to Rav Nissim as follows. Is it possible that a chief rabbi will be the guest of a Mossad of Kashrut, of the Kashrut organizations, that does not listen to Das Torah, and that many of its synagogues do not practice according to the law? Are you the one who fights for a pure Torah value? Are you going to take part in a meal from such an organization? What's going on here? Well, in the 60s, the OU is not like it is today. The Frum world, that is, and the Agudas Rabbanim world, there's chubas about this. They thought that the OU was not reliable. The OK was also not reliable. The OU is not reliable because half the OU shuls, certainly out west half of the OU shuls, you probably have about 200 of them, do not have machitzas. So how could you trust an organization to supply kashrus when all their shuls, you have all these shuls of theirs which don't have machitzas? It's ironic because today the OU is very different. That's because they brought in Haredi Poskim, Rebelski, and others. They made sure to bring other Mashkichim. But when you think that in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, you have Gedolei Torah writing that the chief rabbi should not have anything to do with the OU because the OU was regarded as a modern Orthodox organization on the left. I just think it's fascinating how things have changed. Rav Nissim, in his travels, also went to Iran. In fact, it was under his leadership that various takanot were issued that improved the position of women. We will deal with the issue of takanot when we deal with Remesas, because the real focus for takanot was in Morocco. There's a real activist agenda in this regard, but you also had in Iran, and then Rav Avadya Yosef continued with this with Iran, that inheritance issues, the age of marriage, etc. The Iranian Jewish community has never had, for reasons I can't understand, it's a very big religious community, they've never had Gedolei Torah in the Iranian community. You've never had great poskim. You've had in Iraq, you've had in Syria. I asked, I forget her name, Vera somebody or another, she's a great scholar in Iran. Why is it that you don't have this in Iran? And she didn't have an answer. You have this book, Pitron Torah, that Ephraim Orbach published, but we're talking over 1,000 years ago. Since then, I don't know why we haven't. So he went to Iran. The visit, however, that really catapulted Rav Nissim on the world stage and created a great deal of controversy regarding him was not his visit, but the visit of Pope Paul to Israel in 1964. East Jerusalem and Bethlehem were at this time under Jordanian control. However, Nazareth and the Galilee, both of which are very important for Christianity, were under Israel's authority. So he would have to come. When he came to Israel, he would have to, came to the Holy Land, he would have to go into Israel if he wanted to visit these sites, which obviously any Christian leader is going to want to. The problem was, the Vatican did not recognize the state of Israel yet. The Vatican only recognizes the state of Israel in the reign of Pope John Paul II. And there were no diplomatic relations. Whether this is because they were afraid if they did have diplomatic relations, this would negatively affect Jews in the Arab countries, Catholics in the Arab countries, or whether it goes back to their theological idea that Jews have to be the wandering people, that their theology can't accept a Jewish return to the land of Israel, which is, of course, the exact opposite of the evangelicals who need the Jews to return in order for Jesus to come back. It's not clear. However, they didn't have diplomatic relations. Yet, this was also the era of Vatican II, when the church was taking enormous steps to create a new relationship with the Jews, was really reaching out. They were revising their theology so Jews not be cast in a bad light, as had been the case for 1,700 years. The problems began when the Pope refused to mention the name Israel. He spoke of going to Palestine. Now, the Vatican's plan was that he would fly to Jordan, see the sites, East Jerusalem and the other holy sites, in Jordan, then cross over into Israel for a day and return. The Pope refused to meet the leaders of Israel at any place where could be seen as representing Jewish rule over the land, such as in the president's house. Visiting dignitaries always come and pay a visit to the president's house, to the prime minister's office and the like. They go to the Knesset. Instead, the Pope said that he wants to meet the Israeli leaders in Megiddo. That's in Israel. But this has no significance for Jews, Megiddo. Megiddo is also known as Armageddon. It's, according to Christian conceptions, this is going to be the final site, the final battle between good and evil. So this has Christian significance, but doesn't have any Jewish significance. the Israeli government decided not to fight with the Vatican. And it was decided that President Shazar and Rabbi Nissim would go to meet the Pope. Imagine everyone's surprise when Rav Nissim declares that he refuses to go meet the Pope. Now, this achieves worldwide coverage. Newspapers all over the world, as you can imagine, are covering this. Israeli chief rabbi snubs the Pope, refuses to meet with the Pope. And the implications of this were enormous, especially in the Vatican II era. Rav Nissim explained, however, and he explained to all the newspapers, anyone who wanted to ask him, that it does not reflect Jewish honor to go meet the Pope if he refuses to come to Jerusalem and meet the chief rabbi in his office. That is, the Pope can't just summon, like he's still the ruler of the Jews, and summon the Jews to appear anywhere he wants. The way it was set up, the Pope was superior to everyone else, and they're going to visit the Pope as if he's king or something. Yeah, but, okay, you make a good point. However, there's other issues that need to be of concern. Catholic leaders, how they relate to Jews, so when I say Vatican II, I don't just mean the Vatican per se, but the Catholic change, unless you say the whole thing didn't concern him, but we'll see, it concerned other people very much, including rabbis. As I said, the proper practice is that the visiting dignitary comes, you can meet him, and Rav Nissim would have no problem, let's say, meeting him at the airport, but then a second visit has to be paid at the home or the office of the chief rabbi, the prime minister, or the like, and Rav Nissim said it's not his kavod, it's the kavod of the Jewish people and the Jewish religion. Now, the pressure put on Rav Nissim was incredible. You can speak, those who want more details that have never been published even, you could speak to Robert Bonfil, a great scholar of Renaissance Italy, professor at Hebrew University, retired recently, wrote many important books. But before he was a professor at Hebrew University, he was a Rav in Milan, Italy, and then he comes to Israel and becomes secretary to Rav Nissim. He was his personal secretary. Or you could say, Chaim, an example of Sephardim really not sensing the significance of Catholicism in the lives of Jews. You know, these are people who come from the Arab world. It's very different. Jews who grew up in Poland, Jews in Latin America, Jews who see the importance of the church and the importance of not offending church leaders. You know, I think you might want to phrase it that way. The Golos mentality, not in the bad sense, but in the sense that Jews know how they have to live in the Golos. It could be that it was irresponsible, what Rav Nissim did. Golda Meir, the foreign minister, was especially enraged because she said that Rav Nissim is an employee of the state of Israel and he's acting beyond his authority. When we order Rav Nissim to go somewhere, he goes, and Golda Meir wanted him fired. Numerous government leaders tried to convince him to back down, arguing that Catholics would see this as an attack on Catholicism. An attack on their Pope is an attack on Catholicism, at the very moment that Catholicism is revising its views on Judaism and the Jews. Now, we had something like this a month ago with this crazy Bishop Williamson. Jews, for the most part, kept quiet, and you didn't need to say anything about this Holocaust denier. I mean, if you see that with him, you really see the worst face of pre-Vatican II Catholicism, like Eastern Europe-type Vatican II Catholicism. But the Jews didn't need to say anything. The outcry in Catholicism was so much. The German prime minister calls up. You have liberal theologians making an outcry. And, you know, who was behind this in the Vatican? I don't know. I find it hard to believe that the Pope himself knew the implications. But in any event, for issues like this, it's sometimes smarter for Jews not to say anything. And if you think back to the fight over Mel Gibson's movie, had Abe Foxman just kept his mouth shut, this wouldn't have become a whole cause celeb, and he turned it into such a popular movie. And I work in a Catholic university, and I can tell you that they had no clue as to why the Jews were so angry. And at the end of the day, it didn't mean anything. All these talks that there'd be pogroms and all that, you have to be careful with people of goodwill in the Christian faith not to needlessly antagonize them. Among those who wrote to Rav Nissim in this regard was Rav Solomon Gaon, who was the chief Sephardic rabbi in England. and also David de Sola Poul, the rabbi of the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. But Rav Nissim refuses to back down. In the end, Shazar, Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, Abba Eden, and numerous others greeted the Pope, but not Rav Nissim. And as you can imagine, in the Haredi world, the Orthodox world, he was cheered as a hero, and perhaps he was a hero, but the fact is that it was very controversial, and it's hard to know. At the time, it seemed like a bad thing, at least for most people. Let me now begin to talk about the halachic postures and positions of Rav Nissim, or at least some of them, which I think are interesting, significant, as with every posek. I mean, we could spend lots of classes dealing with him, but I think there's some things which continue on with lasting significance. One of the most important of his psakim dealt with the status of the B'nai Yisrael in India. Who are the B'nai Yisrael? Well, Indians, Jews have lived in India for hundreds of years, going back to Dutch rule in the 17th century. In fact, there were Jews before that, if you count Goa, which is the Portuguese settlement on the western part of India in the 16th century. Later, the Inquisition is established in Goa. You had these Jews in Portugal and Spain who tried to flee the Inquisition and went to the most far-flung colonies you can imagine. But eventually, it usually took 100 years or so, but eventually the Inquisition was established in all these places. In later years, India had a very important community of Iraqi Jews. But there was another community, and this is known as the B'nai Israel. We don't know much about its history. The B'nai Israel claim that they go back to the days of Antiochus, when their ancestors left the land of Israel because of persecution. Who knows the truth on these matters? Much like the Ethiopian Jews, their Judaism was very different than mainstream Judaism. They had very little in the ways of traditional prayers like we have, but they had kashrut, they had Shabbos, they had holidays, they clearly identified as Jewish. A few hundred years ago, they first come into contact with mainstream Judaism. They had no contact till then. Many of its people actually became prominent citizens. In 1937, the mayor of Bombay, now Mumbai, was a B'nai Yisrael. The Iraqi Jews, however, refused to intermarry with them because they didn't trust their yichus. They didn't know if these are Mamzerim, if they're intermarried, if they're really Jewish and the like. This didn't create real problems, because you had the B'nai Yisrael community and you had the Iraqi community. As far as I know, you didn't really have problems raised for intermarriage. You had a couple questions in the 19th century, as I mentioned, but it wasn't a real issue. It wasn't like the Karaite problem, which Jews and Karaites were constantly intermarrying in places like Egypt. But the problem begins with the state creation of the State of Israel, because these B'nai Yisrael, understandably, want to return to the land of Israel, and then what are you going to do? They're going to be integrated into the rest of the Jewish community, and they're going to fall in love and marry other Jews. The chief rabbinate was called to investigate. This was under Rav Nissim's authority, and they actually learned something very interesting, that there is no divorce in the B'nai Yisrael. That is, when they no longer live with one another, the woman does not remarry, so there's no problem mamzerut, that is, of illegitimacy. And even if there was divorce, they could have gone another route, that there's no real marriages, halach marriages. Under Rav Nissim's leadership, the chief rabbinate ruled that it's permissible to marry with B'nai Yisrael if you can show that there's no divorce, that is, looked back 2-3 generations, if there's no divorce and remarriage, which, as I said, never happened, so that's easy enough. And if there's no intermarriage, they can marry. And that became psak, and today there's no issues, no problem, there's no giur l'chumra, that is conversion for the sake of stringency. The psakim are published in this rare book, B'nai Yisrael, Piskei Halakha Makorot. You have letters here from Rav Nissim, Rav Herzog, we dealt with it earlier, Rav Shlomo Rozovsky, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ponovej, Rav Tzvi Kaiser Frank's son-in-law, who also was cooperating with the chief rabbinist, Rochelle Israeli, or Vadia Hadaya, and others. So you have, in addition, you have all the historical sources, the various travelers, what they report, the issues, all sorts of good stuff. All the historical and halakhic investigation begins with this booklet, which is impossible to get. 2 years ago in Israel, I happened to walk into a book dealer in Jerusalem, near Hecho Shlomo. If you're going on the right-hand side, not the one across from the Pods Hotel, and for about $1, he's selling this. So I was very lucky to pick this up. Let me mention now a few interesting responsa. Let me pull up the sefer here. From Rav Nissen's volume of responsa, known as Yain HaTov. Here it is. Not a very large volume, just two volumes, although put in one. It's called Yain HaTov. Just dropped a book here, so let me get these books. It's called Yain HaTov. I've seen many people, including great scholars, who mistakenly refer to it as Yain HaTov. It actually comes from a verse in the Song of Songs, and it's in the construct. So it's Yain HaTov. Why? How I know that it's in the construct, and it's Yain HaTov, not Yain HaTov, only because it appears in Nach that way. Otherwise, you could have assumed it would be Yain HaTov. There's also a work called Yain HaTov on the Targumim. It translates all the Targumim into modern Hebrew. And why Yain? All the Sephardim, when they write books, they allude to their names. Yain, as in Yain, Yud, Yud, Nun, Yitzhak Nissim. One of his interesting questions. He's asked if you could have a wedding and get a haircut on Yom HaTzma'ut. We all know that Yom HaTzma'ut comes out during Sphira. Without going through all his argumentation, he concludes that on the day of a miracle, which occurred during Sphira, you can get married and cut your hair. If you were saved or something and the like, and if you regard it as a miracle, Yom HaTzma'ut falls into that category. So weddings are permissible, all sorts of parties are permissible, cutting your hair. He says, with regard to Yom HaTzma'ut, although our hope was that the political revival would be accompanied by a spiritual redemption and the direction of the state would be based on Jewish principles, we have not merited this. But this does not darken the joy at the political revival, because that which is lacking can be replaced. And our prayer is that God will give us a complete and true redemption soon. And when I say that you can have a wedding in Yom HaTzma'ut, this is significant, because in Israel you need the rabbis to marry you. So you can't just say, I'll have my own wedding. The fact that Rav Nissim decides you can have a wedding means that all the rabbis of the cities can now marry you. You can schedule your wedding for the day of Yom HaTzma'ut. Had he ruled otherwise, other chief rabbis were not so sure about this. You can look in the book I mentioned before, the different opinions, but you can now get married and the rabbi will perform the wedding. Another interesting question. In fact, by next class, I'll make a note of this. The next class, because I think it's interesting, in the book that I showed you before, it goes through the various rabbinic opinions on these issues, and I will I'll mention what the other great rabbis, Rav Unterman, Rav Herzog, and the like, what they held about weddings on Yom HaTzma'ut. I don't know the practice in America. I'm assuming we don't do weddings in Yom HaTzma'ut, because I guess Haredim then wouldn't be able to come, and many of us have rabbis who are involved. I don't know. I didn't Rav Schachter give some heter for this? I can't recall. But in any event, I'm assuming we don't do weddings in America. But in Israel, they will do weddings. He was asked, I say Israel, they will do weddings. Take that back. I'm not sure anymore if they'll do weddings. I don't know what the chief rabbi today holds. Let's say in Israel, they did do weddings. He was asked if Germany has the status of a Malik. People were saying after World War II that Germany has status of a Malik. I'm not sure what the practical implications of this would be, but that's the question. And he says we cannot apply the mitzvah of a Malik to any other nation. He notes the famous view of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik that a Malik is not only a biological thing. Rather, a Malik, we apply the status of a Malik to any nation that attempts to destroy the Jewish people. Rav Soloveitchik quotes this also. If I'm not mistaken, though, he quotes in the name of his father, Moshe Soloveitchik, but it's famous in yeshivas in Rav Chaim. Rav Nissim says that there is no source for this comment of Rav Chaim. And in the midst of his tshuva, which relates to how Jews should deal with Germany, he also discusses the supposed chayrim against Spain. Now, this is quite interesting to me because my first scholarly article, my first one I wrote, was on the Cherem on Spain. Is there a tshuva in Rivos Ephraim? I believe there is, but I don't think I quoted it. I think it came out after my article. I wrote an article in the 80s when I was still in college in the journal Sefarad on the supposed Cherem against Spain. Today, I wish I hadn't published it then because it would read like a college term paper. If I did it now, it would be a lot better. But I guess that's always with your young articles. Okay, Rabbi Kelvin. You should go. Okay, I've heard that, by the way, from other poskim as well, that you should go. I even had a case like this, and I did go to the wedding. I spoke to Rabbi Dov Windsor about it and to some other people, and they also showed me some more sources. So I forgot what Rabbi Windsor showed me. There's a... I have to do... source. Yeah.
It says in the Shulchan Aruch that if a person gets married in the middle of Sfira, ain't klunch, you know, so you don't punish him. It's only a minhag. And getting married is much more important. So Rav Moshe writes, don't punish him. If you don't show up to a wedding, there's no greater punishment. And Rav Shechter always used to emphasize, it's more important to go to a non-firm, you know, relative than the firm relatives even who get married, because you want to show them that being firm doesn't mean you ignore the non-religious side of the family.
Okay, that's very good. I mean, I think that's a standard stock, and after all, what are you doing? We allow an Avel to do a... I remember Rabbi Windsor, he told another rabbi also, maybe act as a servant, you know, pour some wine or something, which is what we tell someone who's an Avel has to go to a child's wedding. So there's certainly a terem on that. So the Cherem of Spain has always held a place in my heart. I collected all the sources. But I didn't know about this tshuva of Rav Nissim because it doesn't say in the index or anything, the table of contents. It's just about Germany. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who we'll speak about later, he becomes the successor of Nissim. He pointed this out to me. When I asked him what he thinks, does he know anything about this Cherem on Spain, he said... to look in this tshuva of Rav Nissim. Yes, Rheinlander, I have the article in Hamar. I could send you it. It was by a rise or something. They thought that there was a cherem on Spain. There's absolutely historically no cherem on Spain. Rav Nissim points this out. But he does discuss, you know, how they would avoid going to Spain because, you know, although it's not an official cherem, it wasn't a place that we'd want to go to. Truth be told, we don't even say they avoided it. The law was that any Jew, this is stated in the decree of the expulsion, any Jew found in Spain after the date of the expulsion, which contrary to the legend invented by Abarbanel was not Tisha B'Av, but any Jew found after the expulsion is executed. And this became quite interesting when Jews began to resettle. Jews started settling again in Spain in the 20s. The first synagogue was given permission to open up in the 60s, and Spain and Israel resumed diplomatic relations in the 1980s. Shimon Peres goes there in 1984, and I think it's 1984, he was prime minister then, if I'm not mistaken. Well, lo and behold, a Spanish newspaper publishes an article declaring that according to Spanish law, the police have the authority to go grab Shimon Peres and execute him because, believe it or not, although Jews have been living in Spain now for about 70, 80 years and they have diplomatic relations, the expulsion order had not yet officially been lifted. While Peres was there, the parliament met the very next day and officially, only in the 1980s, I think it was 84, officially lifted the expulsion order. Until that time, the official law in Spain, and there was plenty of Jews living in Spain, was that Jews could be executed for stepping foot in Spain. Now there's a nice community in Spain, Rav Ezra Basri, who's not based in Jerusalem, an important Sardic postake. He is the chief rabbi there. He travels back and forth from Jerusalem. In fact, I was in the store the other day, and I saw that there's wine from Spain with his hashkacha. In fact, someone asked, I was in the wine store, someone asked, can I rely on this hashkacha? They never heard of him. He's one of the great postkim of the land of Israel. You can certainly rely on his hashkacha if they happen to sell that wine. I picked up another interesting wine from Trieste, the rabbinate of Trieste. All sorts of wine. But I didn't know this tshuva, so I thanked in my article, I thanked Rav Mordechai Eliyahu for pointing this out. He also discusses, I don't know anywhere, please send me Chaim, that Rav Herzog actually has a tshuva dealing with Spain. Rav Meshulam Roth has a tshuva dealing with, and in my article I quote all the sources that I could find, many sources dealing with Spain. I didn't know that they won any medals. That's interesting. And, of course, in 1992, there was all sorts of commemorations. I see it's 10 o'clock. There's still some we need to do. We'll do that next time. We have three more classes. So we'll spend next class some more on Rav Nissim's halachic positions. Then we'll deal with what happens with Rav Avadi Yosef pushing him out. This really becomes interesting. You know, fights between rabbis sometimes are quite interesting, but this also has historical significance. Is our Sephardim going to be led by the Ben Ish Chai, by the Iraqi tradition as our Iraqis, or are we going to have a revolution in a halachic approach? And then I guess we'll finish halfway through probably, or three quarters. We'll move on for the last classes, or maybe we'll go the whole next class on Nissim, although I don't think so, on to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. I can already see that we're not going to get to Rav Mesas this semester, so we will do him next semester. One of you was interested in knowing what we're going to do with Rav Mesas. You know who he was. There's a lot to do with him. We will not meet next class because it's Purim, so we'll pick up in three classes. Rabbi Kelman, you weren't here when I made a bit of an appeal for people, not just for donations, but just to look around on the website. There's all sorts of interesting shiurim and lectures. You can buy previous classes of mine if you haven't. They sell them in a bundle, a group. So let's see. Any questions? Thank you, Eva. This is found in his book. I have it on the floor here. I'll show you. Oh, no, here it is. Rav Avadi Yosef just doesn't stop. He keeps going. It's incredible. He has his Yabia Omer, he has his Yechavadat, and now he's putting out this book, Chazon Avadia, in which he's going through every single halachic area, and he's creating his own, a new Shulchan Aruch. I don't see why you need this book. You have the Yalkut Yosef. But it's like the Yalkut Yosef with up-to-date things. It's from this book that I mentioned a few weeks ago. He gave his interesting psak that Rabbi Natsaf of Montreal called to my attention, that you can ride on Shabbos and let's say the train or anything. If you're a Moel, you need to go. You hop on the public transportation, which we already saw was a typical Sephardic approach, and Rabbi Yitzhak Ochanan also mocked it. We dealt with this in previous classes. So in his Chazon Avad on Purim, he has about four or five pages on this issue, and he says the exact same thing he said today, that this is not something you should do. We should use a man, because there are some posting that don't approve of this. But if you don't have a man who can do it or can do it properly, you can use the woman. And in his talk today, just to focus on the Ashkenazic aspect, he said, if you have a girl, a woman, who's going to Beis Yaakov, and she can read well, she should read the Megillah instead of a man who doesn't know it. If you need it, by the way, I can make a PDF and send it to you. But you can also, if you want to listen, I'll send you the link. Or just go to myron1.com and plug in the shiurim for Motzei Shabbat. And it's about 15 minutes in. You can hear. It's hard to hear. It went in and out. And in general, his accent is very hard. Unlike Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who's at harav.org, and his Hebrew is very clear. With Rav Avadi Yosef, it's very, the accent, a very deep Arabic accent. I sometimes have a hard time making out what he's saying. Yeah, I will be in Scranton tomorrow, so I will, God willing, have my secretary make a PDF and send it to you in time for Purim. By the way, Rav Avadia also says, and this is worth noting, that women, you know, the issue of women reading Megillah for other women becomes a very controversial thing. You have many rabbis who are opposed to it because they think of the slippery slope, where it will lead to. In my town, the Rav tried to ban it. Rav Avadia Yosef, not just him, many rabbanim, but Rav Avadia says it's actually a good thing for women. He encourages women reading for other women. I don't know why per se he encourages it. I think it's, I can't recall exactly, he doesn't see anything wrong with it. And then he says it's a positive thing. I think for women, it's easier for them. Women can get together. He could hear it better. I guess that would be some of his reasons. I don't recall if he actually explains why, but he thinks this is a positive thing. And many other people, Reb Lichtenstein, I believe Nachum Rabinovich and others, think that women reading for Megillah, women reading Megillah for other women is actually a good thing. Again, this every Rav has to decide himself if it's a feminist issue, when it's going to lead to separate women's minyanim, women reading Kriyas HaTorah. I can certainly see a reason for not permitting it, but just the idea that a woman can read for other women is permissible. Okay, just wait 1 minute more if there's any other comments or questions. Chaim Landrer, please, if you could send me some of that stuff. Let me tell you, it's certainly not easy speaking when you have people here who know more about me than many things, but that's what it says in Pirkei Avos. You learn more from your students. You are my students for this hour. So I appreciate all you people who email me during the week with sources. I'm most grateful. Rav Henkin says it's not kavod for tea. Yes, Rav Henkin says that. And Rav Rabinovich says, similarly, on Simchas Torah in his new volume of Tshuvot, that we allow little kids under bar mitzvah to carry a Sefer Torah. And if we allow my 6-year-old to carry the Sefer Torah, it's supposed to, you know, I held the top and he carried it. And Rabinovich says that if we allow children to carry the Sefer Torah, it's really a disgrace to say that women can't carry the Sefer Torah. So, yeah, but if I mention Kabbalah Shabbos, I'll say that this is a problem. You know, if women are going to start reading Megillah, they'll say, certainly there's no halachic objection to say Kabbalah Shabbos, but we know the slippery slope. But there have been kids who read Kabbalah Shabbos, but there are many who hold that a kid can read the Torah if they know what they're doing. We do not allow kids to read the Torah. I think Rav Avadia even holds it, but certainly this is a very common Sephardic practice, that a child who knows what he's doing, he can be called up and read the Haftarah, but not only the Haftarah, he can even read the Torah. And the Haftarah, this is done all the time in Sephardic lands, but we don't do any of these things. Okay, thank you all very much. Have a happy Purim, and God willing, next week. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.